Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, and Judge Reyes. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the Court of Appeals for this April 10, 2024 panel of cases. We have five cases on our docket for today, three of which we'll be hearing by oral argument and two by non-oral. Our first case on our calendar this morning, I'm going to give it a try here. Peggy, is it Adagjaye? Close? Adagjaye, all right. You seem like you're not sure.
I practice it many times.
All right, Adagjaye. I will mispronounce it, I'm sure we all will, but we'll do our best with apologies. Versus BB Home Healthcare as the relator. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to relator for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They're indicated in the light and the clock that's in the lectern. And you should know that there is a button in front of the lectern to raise or lower the height at your convenience. Please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track on our audio recording, so the parties can be known as who they're represented by for those who are listening but who aren't privy to the live stream today. Counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed for a relator, you may.
May it please the court. My name is Alicia Anderson, and I represent the relator, BB Home Healthcare. There's one issue in this case, and it's whether Peggy Adagjaye was an employee or an independent contractor for BB Home Healthcare. Before I address this issue, I'm going to give some brief facts and the procedural history of this case, and then discuss the factors that are used for determining worker status. Barbara Burns started BB Home Healthcare in 2019 to provide personal care services for the elderly and disabled. She's the sole owner of this small business. Peggy Adagjaye came to work for her for about 5 months in November of 2022. She is a personal care attendant, and she provided personal care services to one of BB Home Healthcare's clients, Sharon, at Sharon's home at Presbyterian Homes.
Now, you're perfectly welcome to elaborate on the facts, but just so you know, the panel has received your briefs, and we're apprised and ready to go on the issues if you're ready to jump into the issues. It's entirely up to you.
All right. I will jump into the issues in that case. As you probably are aware, there are five factors that go into determining worker status, and those are listed in Minnesota Rule 3315.0555. And those are the right to control the means and manner of the performance. Two is liability, whether there's any liability upon termination of the working relationship. And three, is mode of payment. Four is the furnishing of tools or materials, and five is control over the premises. Now, the rule states that of these five factors, the two most important are the right to control and liability. And in the precedential case of St. Croix Sensory v. Deed, which was decided by the Minnesota Appellate Court in 2010, they said that the most important factor when you're determining whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor is the control factor.
Aside from that, before you get into the control factor, I'm just curious about the mode of payment factor.
Yes.
The parties talk about the hourly basis for the payment, but I'm misunderstanding the factor, but when I think of mode of payment, I'm thinking, are you paid by check? Are there deductions for Social Security? Is it a 1099, W-2, those sorts of things? Am I misunderstanding what mode of payment means?
Well, I think there's different understandings for it. One is, of course, the hourly, whether someone is paid hourly. And then in the cases that I've read, that's the main consideration that seems to be there. But you do make a good point, because in the case of Peterson v. AZ Friendly Language, and that's a non-presidential case from this court. And in that case, they talked about the fact that it was an interpreter, and because the interpreter was responsible for her own taxes and was paid through a 1099, that factor weighed in favor of an independent contractor relationship under the mode of payment factor.
Thank you. Can I ask one other question?
Yes.
After I've taken you off the track of giving us the facts, I do have a factual question, and that's Burns. Do we know whether, I think it's Ms. Burns, right?
Ms. Burns.
What her relationship is to your client? I didn't see a finding whether she was an employee or whether she was just in the same condition, whatever that is, as the respondent in relationship to your client.
Well, it's always been Burns's contention that Adaji is an independent contractor. And unfortunately, the unemployment law judge found the contrary, that she was an employee.
No, I understand that. But there was some reference made to the fact that Burns had some supervisory relationship. It may or may not matter, depending on Burns' relationship to your client.
I don't know that I would say that there's a supervisory relationship. I would say that Barbara Burns is the owner of the company, and she has to abide by strict government regulations from the Department of Human Services. And so she does have to ensure that anyone who is working under her umbrella is complying, is complying with those requirements.
But Burns is not a PCA herself.
Actually, she is also a PCA, and she will cover if someone doesn't show up for their shift. She can also fill that role.
Okay, but Burns is an employee of your client. There's no question about that. An owner or employee. She's directly related to your client. She's not just another PCA who is assigned to
Burns
Sharon.
Barbara Burns is the sole owner of BB Home Health.
Understood. That wasn't clear in the.
Oh, okay.
Now it's clear.
Sorry.
At least to me. Maybe it was clear otherwise. Sorry.
I have one other question about the facts. Was there differences between the testimony of Ms. Burns and Ms. Adaje? And if so, on what issues? Differences or conflicts in their testimony?
Well, excuse me. I think that one thing I noticed when I read through the transcript is that the unemployment law judge specifically asked Adaji if she was getting training. And so Adaji's answers to that, she kept saying she was getting training, but the thing she was explaining is basically I'm getting introduced to Sharon and Sharon's family and learning about Sharon's preferences and her needs. And as we have seen in St. Croix Sensory v. Deed, if you are communicating a general instruction from the client to the worker, that does not demonstrate control.
Are there any other factual issues? I think I agree with you that I think Adaje answered that question yes, and I think Ms. Burns answered it no. Was there any training? And then they both described, I think. But I think what they both described was fairly similar as far as, you know, I think they had, it was more about the definition of the word training probably in their minds. Was there any other factual issue in which their testimony diverged or was in conflict?
There wasn't a lot that was in conflict. So our thesis is that it was a error of law that the unemployment law judge made. Going back to the control factor, when she said the unemployment law judge contends that Burns' statement to Adaji that she needed to treat Sharon like her own mother demonstrated control, that was not an instruction. She did not tell Adaji how to treat her like her own mother. That was a directive about the standard of care that she should provide. It was not an instruction about how to do that. And there's nothing in the record that goes into any detail about what Burns has meant when she said treat her like your own mother. It was up to Adaji to use her own judgment to figure that out. The unemployment law judge also erred when she concluded that, although we've already kind of touched on this, the requirement to follow checklists and make entries in a journal. She commented that, she said, quote, even if Burns's requirements of Adagio were based on DHS's requirements, that's the Department of Human Services, it was Burns that communicated these expectations to Adagio, end quote. And that's in the deeds addendum in A8. But under the control factor analysis, we've already seen that whether she's the communicator is not relevant to the issue determining control. The court went on in St. Croix to say, quote, instructions required by laws or regulations or general instructions passed on by the employer from a client do not evince control. And that's in St. Croix at 802. And there are other examples of this court deciding that, for instance, in Benko Delivery Services, the VD, the company leased the vehicles that belonged to the drivers, but the court said because that was a requirement of the Department of Transportation, that did not evince control.
The difference is here, I think, perhaps, that in the event that Ms. Adagio failed to follow the checklist and to do those things that may have been passed through your client from DHS, I'm assuming your client would then discipline or discharge any PCA who failed to comply, whether the requirement came originally from your client or DHS would seem not to have a bearing on that. Is that correct? If I'm wrong about it, or if that doesn't matter, please explain why.
Well, I would say that it was similar to, this case is more similar to the Peterson case. We had the interpreter. And in that case, the unemployment law judge said that there was lots of facts demonstrating control, and that was because the employer had policy, or the employing entity had policies that the interpreter had to follow. But the court on review said, well, those policies are just a reflection of the client's requirements. It's the client requiring that you not wear perfume or that you dress professionally. So and the court acknowledged, if I recall correctly, that if an interpreter did not follow these requirements, then they would simply not offer them another job again. And it's the same situation here, where Adagio had the choice to work or not, and Burns.
Well, this is slightly different from instructions, I think, coming from the client. These would be instructions coming from your client, the BB, through or from, ultimately, from DHS. But still, aren't they obligations that your client would impose and then discharge a PCA for not following through? I'm assuming there's some consequence, and the DHS might impose some consequence on your client if a PCA that was placed by your client failed to follow DHS regulations.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
So how does that, you see how that it's slightly different from a client making a request for certain things to occur and your agency making a requirement of a DHS requirement, passing along the requirement.
Right. Well, I think in that case, Ms. Burns would simply say, you can't come back. You broke one of their rules, so you can't come back.
I gather you're not disputing the second factor, the right to discharge without incurring liability.
We are not disputing that factor. We are conceding that, but we contend that the control factor is so much more heavily weighted in favor of an independent contractor relationship that is what the final determination should be. And there are several cases that the Minnesota Court of Appeals has decided where there was liability for the employer, and yet they still found that it was an independent contractor. A couple examples are Benko Delivery Service v. Deed. There was no liability to terminate any drivers, but the court said that because they had the right, the drivers had sufficient control over their own day-to-day duties, that factor weighed more heavily, and therefore they were independent contractors.
Well, can you speak more then about what the evidence, the findings were sort of bare bones, but can you point to testimony that, or other evidence that would bear for or against your position as it regards the control?
Yes. Adaji was not supervised. This is in the transcript at pages 53 and 64. Adaji had complete control over her schedule. This is in the transcript at 31 and 76. Adaji exercised her own judgment when deciding what activities to do with Sharon. This is in the transcript at pages 74 and 75. Adaji was not required to attend any meetings. This is in the transcript at page 51, lines 23 through 25. She was not required to wear a uniform. This is the transcript 54, lines 9 through 11. Adaji was not disciplined. This is in the transcript at 53, lines 11 through 14. Adaji was free to work other jobs, 55 at lines 14 through 18. And their BB Home Healthcare did not have any written policies or training manuals. And this is in the transcript at 85. Excuse me. In conclusion, substantial evidence demonstrates that it was Adaji and not BB Home Healthcare that had the right to control the means and manner of her performance. The unemployment judge erred, and we respectfully request this court to reverse that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Okay.
Counsel for respondent.
Hey, good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips. I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED for short. So as counsel noted, the two most important factors to consider are the right to discharge without liability and the right to control the manner of performance. Relator does not dispute that the right to discharge factor weighs in favor of employment. Rather, Relator argues that the ULJ's determination on right to control is incorrect and cites to Burns' testimony in the transcript about lack of supervision. But the ULJ's findings are based on a credibility determination that Adaji's testimony was more credible than Burns' testimony on right to control. And the ULJ's credibility determination is supported by Adaji's specific firsthand testimony regarding instructions and training that she received on the job.
So generally, and there's one that you identified, but what are the issues where the party's testimony is in conflict?
So Ms. Burns testifies that she did not supervise Ms. Adaji, that she wasn't, you know, in the house supervising her, that it was up to Ms. Adaji as to what she did each day based on her own judgment. Ms. Adaji testified that Ms. Burns did come to the house, that she would tell her, do this or don't do that. You know, for example, the bathroom's not clean. Style her hair this way. Shampoo her this way. Ms. Adaji testified, she told me everything to do. Ms. Adaji testified, I knew what to do each day based on my training.
Did Ms. Adaji testify how often Ms. Burns came to the home?
No, I don't believe there was a testimony about how frequently. Ms. Burns testified that she frequently came to the house, I believe.
I think she said once in a while.
Once in a while, okay. Yeah, I can't give you a concrete answer. I know Ms. Adaji testified she would come by and give us instructions on how to do things. So there was a dispute about whether Ms. Burns was supervising or controlling Ms. Adaji's work in the residence. And the ULJ kind of specifically addressed that point in her credibility determination. She says... Hey,
what other issues are there where the testimony is in conflict?
That's the main one. I think that's the primary point of contention is how much Ms. Burns was involved in Ms. Adaji's work at the House. Like you mentioned before, there is some perhaps some disagreement about training. Ms. Adegay testified that she was there for that she was trained over the course of an 8-hour day.
In my view, tell me if you disagree with this. I mean, the party's testimony about whether it's called training or orientation, I think, is the only dispute. The party's testimony about what occurred was about the same. I get it that Glenda, who was a friend of Ms. Adegay, who already worked there and referred her to BB, gave her sort of 6 to 8 hours of explanation about what this particular woman likes and doesn't like and how, you know, and her living arrangements in place and so on. And so, but Ms. Adegay had previous work as a PCA, right? She knew how to do a PCA's job.
That's right.
But she just needed some, introductory information about this particular client or woman.
Yeah, how to care for this particular client. I agree with that. She did know how to be a PCA, but her testimony was, I was shown what to do every day, step by step. She also talks about the checklist that Ms. Burns wrote. She calls it a step by step.
The checklist. I mean, do we have a copy of the? We don't have a copy of the checklist, do we?
We don't.
But I mean, does the checklist tell somebody how to do the job, or is it just, there was a brief description in the testimony. It just seems like, you know, whether the person has had breakfast or lunch, and whether the person has had a bowel movement. But I mean, is there step-by-step instructions about how to assist the person in doing a bowel movement or in eating breakfast or lunch?
Ms. Adegay, her testimony is that it is a step-by-step instructions on what to do each day.
So is it what to do or how to do it?
Well, it is kind of what is to be done. She testifies, she's also kind of instructed on how to shampoo her hair, for example. But I think the checklist, kind of talking through this out loud, the checklist I think is more, you know, what is to be done step by step each day. Make sure she drinks water. Sorry to interrupt you. Make sure she takes a walk. Make sure she gets her breakfast. So I think that is kind of specific instructions about what is to, what is she is to do step by step, kind of sequence of events. You know, that definition of control in St. Croix Sensory mentions specific oral or written instructions about what, when, where, and how the work is to be done and the sequence of the work. I think the checklist is an example of that. It's giving her kind of a sequence of what she is to do each day with the client.
So is that checklist specific to this client, or is that checklist just general for any client?
I don't believe that's clear in the record. Ms. Adegay testifies that Ms. Burns created the checklist. Ms. Burns testifies that she and the client's family provided the checklist, which would lead me to infer that it was specific for the client, since the client's family may have been involved in that. As far as whether it's the same as a checklist for different clients, I don't think the record reveals that information.
But the situation here is we do have an experienced PCA. Adaji is not somebody who has never cared for people before, cared for clients, cared for patients. So I'm just wondering how much control was really exercised over her when, it seems like this is a person who's just like, okay, here's the client, here are her preferences, here's the family's preferences. Go do good. Take care of her.
Yeah.
And so, where is that line between when you hire somebody and you're specifically telling them, okay, I want you to do this way, I want you to do this that way, I want you to do this a particular way, versus here's orientation, here's so-called training, and then let them go.
Yeah, I think that line is maybe illustrated by the party's testimony. Ms. Burns testified, we just told her, you know, she knows what she's doing. We just said, take care of her. And Ms. Adegay's testimony was, no, you told me everything I was supposed to be doing. You told me, you know, I was shown what to do, and that's and that's how I decided what to do every day, was based on what I was told to do. You know, her testimony about training is how to wake and dress the client. Maybe she's woken in a specific way. Maybe she wants to be dressed in a specific way. How to shampoo her hair. When to brush her teeth. So there are kind of some specific instructions on how she is to care for the client that were provided to her in training. It wasn't, you know, just care for her from 8 to 5, do what you will, use your expertise. Ms. Adegay's testimony, which the ULJ credited, was, no, I knew exactly what to do because they told me to do it. And when a new PCA was hired, I told her exactly what was to be done.
Now, you say when they told Ms. Adegay what to do and how to do it, you reference the fact that the family said she has particular needs and wants. Is that direction coming from BB, or is that coming from the family?
So the evidence shows it coming from Ms. Burns, who is BB Home Healthcare. You know, Ms. Adegay testified, you know, they showed me, you know, how to do all these things and what the client likes. So I think, you know, there is an understanding that the instruction is, you know, pursuant to the client's wishes or the client's family wishes. As far as where that's coming from, the evidence shows it's coming from Ms. Burns. There isn't testimony that the family is instructing her or that the family is going into the residence and noting that the bathroom's not clean and that the hair's not
right.
done.
No, right. But I mean, you several times you reference the family's preferences as to how she is cared for. You reference the fact that the family was involved in putting together a checklist to make it specific to her. So I'm just wondering, is that direction of what to do and how to do it, is that really coming from the family, or is it coming from Ms. Burns?
Yeah, and I don't know that the record parses that precisely. I know that the instruction kind of on the ground is coming from Ms. Burns. As far as whether Ms. Burns learned that in discussions with the family, when she contracted with the family, maybe. I'm not sure. I don't think the record tells us kind of how that was formulated, how the checklist was formulated, how the instruction on the hair and the, you know, shampooing was formulated. Maybe that came from the family, or maybe it came from Ms. Burns. I don't think that that's clear, and the record doesn't, like I said, kind of parse that out.
Close cousin to the control, the factor of control of the means and manner of performance is control over the premises where the services are performed. Now, the ULJ weighed that in favor, that factor in favor of employment. And I'm confused about that because I'm getting the impression that Presbyterian Homes is not under the control of BB. Can you discuss that factor and your position on it?
Sure. So I think the ULJ, that was an error in the first decision, and the ULJ corrects it in the decision on reconsideration. In the decision on reconsideration, the ULJ reasons that the two most important factors weigh in favor of employment, the motive pay weighs in favor of employment, and the rest are neutral. So, and I believe that's correct. I think that the control of the premises doesn't weigh kind of in favor of either employment or independent contractor because it's at the client's residence. The client controls the residence, or certainly Home Healthcare does not control it, and nor does Ms. Adegay control it.
Is there any case law that, in a situation where the worker is not at the company's site, and it is not, and then the factor is not determined to be something that favors independent contractor status? Actually, two questions. First of all, is there any precedential case law about determining these five factors to be neutral? I don't think I've ever seen that, and I looked. I mean, it seems like it's either it favors employment or it favors independent contractor status. But I guess it seems to me that, just from general experience, that any time the worker is working elsewhere, I mean, not at the company's site, that's almost always determined to be a factor favoring independent contractor status. Okay. Are you aware of any case law that says otherwise?
I'm not. And I also noticed that the court doesn't use the word neutral. I noticed in some cases the court will say, this doesn't weigh heavily in favor either way, and I think that's what the judge is saying on this factor. But to answer your question, I'm not aware of case law that would weight that factor in favor of.
I mean, it seems to me the question is, I mean, whether the company, I'll say company, whether the company has, you know, this type of control over the worker or not. But if not, I don't know if it matters whether the worker is working at his or her own home or a third-party site or.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you. I think the focus here is whether BB Home Healthcare had the right to control the means and manner of Ms. Adegaye's performance. You know, and they are saying, take her to the dining room. They don't control the assisted living facility, but Ms. Burns is saying, take her to the dining room for her lunch. You know, so, but, you know, she's not at the premises all the time. She does stop in to the premises. So, you know, I would argue that when Ms. Burns is at the premises, kind of inspecting things and telling her, do this, don't do that, there is some control over the premises, perhaps, during those visits. But
are you conflating control over the premises with control over the means and manner?
I may be conflating the two, yeah. You know, the control is happening at the premises, I should say. She's not necessarily controlling because that is a separate entity that owns the care facility.
So. I was struck by the fact that the company does not dictate, you know, when each of the workers, each of the PCAs must work. I mean, that the PCAs work this out among themselves. They do the schedule. Ms. Burns doesn't do the schedule. She says she's given the schedule by Glenda, I believe, and after the PCAs have worked it out among themselves. And so as far as the company is concerned, Ms. Adegaye can work any day she wants or not at all. She can go away on a one-month vacation, come back later, right? Given that general fact pattern, I mean, is there any case law that results in a finding of employee status in that arrangement where, you know, basically the company doesn't do the scheduling, doesn't dictate when and where when the person must work?
Well, generally when there's arrangements where the employee is choosing shifts, it does weigh in favor of independent contractor. Here I would say it is a little different than those types of cases for a few reasons, factually. Ms. Adegaye here was working full-time. She was working a lot of hours. And while she did have some kind of input into the schedule, like I can't work this day, I can't work that day, she was, you know, expected to work her schedule once it was set. And she testified that if she needed to be gone on a vacation, she had to contact Ms. Burns, that all those scheduling concerns went through Ms. Burns. So that was her testimony. The ULJ's findings on the schedule are pretty broad. You know, she doesn't get into kind of those types of details. She does find Ms. Adegaye's testimony credible, and Ms. Adegaye testified, all the scheduling went through you. I don't know why you're saying this. Every time I was gone, I had to tell you I was gone. And it makes sense with the fact that Ms. Burns was the one responsible for providing 24/7 care at the house. So it makes sense that she would have, you know, some oversight of the schedule.
Tell me if I'm correct, Ms. Adegaye was basically saying, like, once the schedule is set, and I think it's set in advance, then if she's going to deviate from the schedule. But isn't it true that the PCAs would first contact other PCAs for coverage?
That's right.
And Ms. Adegaye agreed with that.
Yeah, she
did. So it was only if she could not find any other PCAs to cover, then she would contact Ms. Burns because Ms. Burns would cover it.
That's right. There was testimony from Ms. Adegaye that, you know, if somebody was late, I contacted Ms. Burns, you know, I let her know, and she wasn't okay with that.
Because she had to leave. She was planning to leave, and she needed Ms. Burns to cover for the absent person or the tardy person.
That's right. So Ms. Burns had to ensure that somebody was there. It was her obligation under her contract with, you know, this client's family. So while Ms. Adegaye was, you know, choosing her shifts, it is distinguishable from those cases where, you know, an applicant or, you know, an individual is selecting, you know, blocks of time on a, you know, an online application, you know, 2 hours for this. It's like employment in that she's regularly working full time and she's having to cover when others aren't there. She's having to communicate with Ms. Burns when others don't show up. So in those ways, those facts lean in favor of employment.
Although your time's expired, I'm going to take the liberty to ask one further question of you. The ULJ's finding that Ms. Adegay works full-time was incomplete. I didn't understand whether that meant she's required to work full-time or that she chooses to work full-time for any given pay period.
And I don't believe it's clear. I read it as she just does work full-time. You know, Ms. Adegay's testimony was, I worked as much as I could because I needed the money.
Right.
So I was willing to pick up anything. And Ms. Burns testified she was picking up 12-hour shifts and 24-hour shifts, so she was working a lot of hours.
That suggests independent contractor, doesn't it? I mean, generally speaking, if the employer can choose, you know, I want you to work only 40 hours a week, I want you to work only 20 hours a week, or more or less than that. I was expecting to see more from the ULJ's discussion of what that meant, just that she worked full-time. Didn't say anything if she's in control of her own schedule and she's working with other PCAs to determine what those hours are.
Yeah, I agree that the findings are pretty broad on that. I would say the evidence shows that both parties wanted her to work a lot because there was need for her to work and she wanted to work. So as far as what was required, clear, I guess, in the record.
And as to pay, she was only paid for her hours. She wasn't provided other compensation such as benefits, vacation, sick leave.
That's right. $17 an hour with no other benefits or PTO.
All right. Well, thank you.
Your time is quite
expired.
Okay.
We've wanted to delve into a few things.
Okay.
We'll probably allow a little leeway for the respondent also if we go over, so we can keep things relatively fair.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Counsel for, respondent, for relator.
Relator, yes, thank you.
Any rebuttal?
I just wanted to let the court.
And again, if you could begin by stating your name for.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Alicia Anderson, attorney for BB Home Healthcare.
Thank you.
Now, Burns testified that she was very hands-off with the schedule. In her words, she gave it to the ladies and let them figure it out. She was responsible for Sharon's 24-hour care, so she had to, if there was someone that didn't show up or was late, did fall on her shoulders to take care of that. But that kind of goes back to the hourly wage, the fact that they were paid hourly. That was a more equitable way to pay them in case someone did have to stay longer because the next person was late for their shift.
Any indication in the record that there was ever any penalty or a correction for working too few hours?
No evidence of that. And I don't recall any evidence of them discussing vacation time or discussing how many hours Adaji needed to work. I don't think the record has anything about that.
Counsel, what are we to make of the ULJ crediting Adaji's testimony over Burns? And the ULJ specifically said that her testimony was credible because it was given without hesitation, it was logical and probable and based on firsthand knowledge, and was and Burns' testimony was less credible.
Well, I know that deference is given to the ULJ's credibility determinations, but I would still say that the legal conclusions that she came to were incorrect. For instance, we have the testimony about supervision. I know that was a little bit in debate. And the record reflects that Burns was only there once in a while. So maybe one time she said, maybe you didn't shampoo something correctly. You know, it's not like this was a training that she got about how to shampoo her hair.
How to style hair seems to be a more of a means issue. Now, if she's given specific direction about styling hair and when to provide other personal care services throughout the day.
Well, we didn't get any testimony about what exactly she said about shampooing the hair. I lost my train of thought.
I was asking about whether directives about styling hair would be, if there's a conflict, on that issue, not the ultimate issue or the ultimate legal conclusion, but on that fact, it seems that we would rely upon the ULJ's characterization of more hands-on directives by Ms. Burns. No?
That could be, but we have to keep in mind, too, that communications that come indirectly from the client or the client's family, if it was Sharon or Sharon's family saying, we would prefer you to use X shampoo instead of Y shampoo, then that would not be indicative of control. That would be a communication coming from the family, which St. Croix Sensory v. Deed, which is a precedential decision, said general instructions from the customer that are conveyed to the worker do not demonstrate control. It feels that way, and it probably felt that way to the unemployment law judge, but that's not what the law says.
Am I correct? Does BB Healthcare have more than one client?
At this time, I do not know. I think at that time, that was the main client.
Sharon's family was the only.
Sharon's
family. And I think Ms. Burns testified that the family contacted her and asked her to put together a team, basically. Is that right?
That is my understanding as well.
Maybe I misread the record. I thought I had seen somewhere in maybe one of the findings that there were two clients at the time.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure. It could have been two. I know it wasn't many. It was pretty limited. Are there any other questions that I can address?
Doesn't appear to be from the panel.
All right, I'll just conclude with the substantial evidence suggests that Adaji was an independent contractor and not an employee, and urge you to reverse the decision of the unemployment law judge. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your argument today, your briefing, and your answers to questions. The answers are very helpful, so we appreciate it. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.